Today's edition of the Capital Daily Podcast is brought to you by us, Capital Daily. With a committed audience of over 41,000 people, get connected with some of the smartest, hippest people on the West Coast. For more details, visit capitaldaily.ca. Never miss what's happening in Victoria and on Vancouver Island by subscribing to the Capital Daily newsletter. Each morning, you'll receive all the latest news delivered directly to your inbox, compiled by the experienced Capital Daily team to ensure you are up to date with what's happening on the island and beyond. To subscribe, simply head to capitaldaily.ca. Hi, I'm Ben Waterworth and welcome to the Capital Daily Podcast for Wednesday, November 25th, 2020. Today on the podcast.
You know how a lot of kids would be like, look at the guy, the quarterback or the receiver or the actor in the movie. I was like, look at the guy cheering people on. I could do that.
We chat with professional sports fan Cameron Hughes about how attending a hockey game 26 years ago changed his life and discussing who is a better dancer between Novak Djokovic and Roger Federer. Years ago, Cameron Hughes' life changed forever. Attending an Ottawa Senators game, Hughes found himself disappointed by the uninspired crowd and soon jumped to his feet, started dancing, and began to get the crowd more involved. From that moment on, Hughes found a new calling as a professional sports fan. Since that fateful night, Hughes has gone on to perform at over 1,500 different sporting events in 22 different leagues in front of 18 million people. He's performed at Olympics and Rugby World Cups and has had numerous moments broadcast around the world, including famously dancing with Novak Djokovic on centre court at the US Open in 2015. Hughes, who now lives in Victoria, has recently released a book detailing his experiences and how he ended up taking what for many is a passion and turning it into a lucrative career. And to talk more about his amazing career and just how all of this happened, it's a pleasure to welcome Cameron Hughes to the Capital Daily Podcast today. Cameron, thanks so much for joining me.
Let's go. Come on, bring some cheer.
Yeah, I need some crowd in the background or something like that. It's too quiet here.
Don't we all need someone cheering us on right now?
Indeed. We especially do right now. I tell you one thing. I've interviewed many people with many jobs in my career, Cameron, and I don't think anyone's had a cooler job than you, a professional sports fan. I have to know, how do you go to a NHL game 26 years ago and end up forging a career out of being a fan?
Well, it's funny because I've had a lot of time to think about it. And it's such a, you know, it's an unconventional path, obviously, like, you know, finding your way to do something like this. But then when I look back at putting my, you know, book together and looking at my life and how it all led to this, it really looked like connecting the dots. You know, I was the guy in high school who wanted everyone to have great school spirit. I was the guy in university who, you know, carved a watermelon on his head, went to the football games. I was the guy who became the mascot at, you know, the local baseball team. And then the night I got up and my life changed, I just was like, come on, everybody, let's go. And I finally had that sort of aha moment where I just wanted to be myself, right? And I think that was obviously the defining moment in my life and my career. And I was just being me, you know. I wasn't being a character. I didn't go there with this idea that, oh, I'm going to get the crowd going tonight. It happened organically. And I think that's why I've still had this career.
With that night, so the Ottawa Senators, as in 1994, they hadn't been in the NHL for that long at that point too. So was that just a case, do you think, of the fans at that point, they were still warming up to it? I mean, why did they need that extra cheer that night, Cameron?
Well, yeah, they were the worst team in the NHL by far. It was the middle of January. It was cold. The team was losing. It was a Saturday night. I felt like they wanted to have fun. You know, when you go to an event and it's like you can feel that it just needs something, whatever that might be. Mm-hmm. And I make this joke a lot, but you know, like at a wedding and then Uncle Bill gets up, the crazy uncle, and he does the dance and it changes the whole vibe.
Yeah.
But when you think about that, it's true. You need something to spark it so that everyone else kind of joins in. And that night was a perfect mixture of all of those elements coming together.
Was there a bunch of infectious energy events beforehand? Like, was this something that was inherited from your parents, other family members? Were you kind of the unique pea in the pod, essentially, that you had these boundless amounts of energy that you're always wanting to get people involved?
Well, I grew up in Ottawa. We grew up in a very social town, government town. Might have grown up with, you know, some people that are in politics right now.
Maybe. Just one in particular might be known today.
Yeah, one in particular. But we grew up in a very social environment. You know, it was a safe social environment in Ottawa. And, you know, my parents, as when I was a kid, I remember they would have CFL Grey Cup parties and they would host the tailgates. And I remember always feeling they wanted everyone to feel so welcome and so like that they were having a great time. Like I can remember that as a kid. You know, there's something about those parties and those events that I was just in awe of. So, you know, that helped. And then I had a very unfortunate life moment. And when I was 16, my mom had been diagnosed with breast cancer. She passed away about a year and a half later. And that was the moment where for me, I wasn't like super outgoing. I wasn't shy, but it was just like that kind of like unleashed me in a way. Cause it's like, you know, I say this to a lot of different people and a lot of events I've spoken at. It's like when the worst thing happens to you in the world, what else have you got to lose? Right. Mm-hmm. And it kind of gave me this extra spark and fuel that I probably had in me, but it just elevated it.
And obviously from those tragic circumstances to turn that into something, as you said, to kind of, you know, flick that switch essentially into you to move forward. I can imagine at that age, you didn't realize you wanted to be a professional sports fan, something that didn't really exist. What, before you kind of fell into this, and we'll get to more on that in a second, what did you actually want to be, Cameron? What was kind of the career outlook for you at that point?
Well, as a young kid, I wanted to be a train conductor, obviously.
Of course,
right?
Yes. That and a dinosaur are the two most obvious ones as a child, right? So
obviously, right?
Yeah.
I was looking at being I always wanted to be a teacher. And then it kind of evolved into like an entrepreneur of some kind. I used to like cut lawns in the neighborhood as a, you know, young kid in the lemonade stands and all that. So I kind of liked being creative and business, but I never really knew what that looked like. I used to sell t-shirts at university and had a clothing company. And, you know, then the irony is I started throwing t-shirts at sporty events. And, you know, before there was a t-shirt gun, there was my arm. So, you know, it kind of evolved. Right. Mm. And I think that if I look at the teaching thing, well, I love kids and I love doing speaking events and I love being in front of a classroom, so to speak, or an audience. So that was there. And I love imparting any of the wisdom that I've learned and sharing some fun. And then, you know, and then the other entrepreneurial element is I had to get creative. Like, you know, half my book is about like how you get in the door, you know what I mean? And then how you get in the door again and how you take that no into a yes. And trust me, it's not easy, right? I mean, it's not easy for any entrepreneur, and especially these days, but that's a big part of my story, because what I was doing was offering something that they didn't know they needed, right? Mm. So when I convinced teams, and there's been a lot, that I could bring them value, not just, oh, look, the crazy, big, crazy dancing guy. Oh, no, look, at the end of the game, our fans had more fun. They talked about it more. They left having a good time, win or lose. So all those elements came into play.
Did you go to many sporting events as a child? I mean, what was going on in Ottawa, I guess, when you were growing up before the Senators came around? I'm guessing CFL, things like that.
Yeah, the CFL was there. The Ottawa Rough Riders were there. I used to go to all the games with my buddies, and my dad would sort of drop me off and say, have fun. And then my grandmother, she went to every game for 40 years.
Wow.
And so it was a big family thing for us. And I'll never forget, there's a big moment in my life, and probably around 11 years old. My parents have been divorced for a few years. My dad's doing his best. We're sitting at the game, and I see this guy in section C at the Lansdowne Park in Ottawa. And he's this charismatic guy, big guy. He's got like the construction helmet on with the Rough Riders logo. I remember looking at my dad going, look at that guy, look at that guy. You know how a lot of kids would be like, look at the guy, the quarterback or the receiver or the actor in the movie. I was like, look at the guy cheering people on. I could do that, dad. And he's like, yeah, whatever. And it was sort of like it was like this crazy moment that I still, you know how you have some memories, you just vivid, you know, and then years, you're like, what year was that? That was a really vivid sort of childhood memory.
It's interesting because I remember as a kid going to, we had a basketball team in the national competition in Australia at the time, and vivid memories of being in what was dubbed the family den and, you know, very loud crowd. And then also going to international cricket matches as a kid, I vividly remember we had this guy called Captain Australia. You know, you mentioned the watermelon, put the watermelon on the head, the Australian flag, you know. He was basically, I think, recruited by Cricket Australia to go around the matches and get the crowd. But there are those sort of moments as a kid when you're going to sporting matches and getting involved in the crowd that do connect with you. Some people, though, clearly like yourself, Cameron, that connects with a little bit more because you are eventually able to turn that into a 26-year career and counting.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important. It's interesting you say that about other characters because there's lots of different characters and lots of different people and lots of different things that, you know, not just sporting events, you know, theater events, concerts, etc., that they do to engage their fans and, you know, increase the level of, I believe, authentic energy. You know, yes, I'm planted in the crowd, but it's still a human being. It's not a sign on a big jumbotron saying, make some noise, right? It's like that real human connection. And obviously now we're missing that real human connection on every level. So it's so important. And I think that's why, you know, people are like, well, how have you done this for 26 years? Well, I mean, my first, answer is usually, well, I'm pretty stubborn and resilient. and then the other one is I don't really have a plan B. And then, you know, the lockdown kind of forced me to finish my book that I'd been working on. And, you know, I talk a lot about, you know, betting on yourself. And, you know, when you're with someone with my lack of focus and my writing abilities and all that, people are like, well, you know, people are like, you're an author. And I'm like, well, I guess I am now.
Yeah.
And I look at it and I had some great advice a couple of years ago. This gentleman said to me, if you want to write a book, write your bleeping book, meaning you put it down on paper and then figure it out from there. You know, we all get in our own way. And I was in my own way for a long time with this process.
One thing I have to bring up, you tease it slightly there, you kind of did go to school with Justin Trudeau for a little bit. Was he kind of infectious and rowdy like yourself as a kid? Any fun little moments there, or was he completely the opposite?
Look, there's a group of us, about five of us as kids, grew up together in elementary school in Ottawa. And we, you know, he used to have play dates over and the RCMP would come and sweep the house before he was allowed in. He was a fun kid. He had a lot of energy as a kid. He loved people and, you know, very charismatic. We were all like, we weren't troublemakers. We were just sort of, dare I say, spirited kids. You know what I mean? Like we were the kids that brought everyone together too. So, yeah, I mean, like I said, being in Ottawa and, you know, safe city like that back in the day, it was pretty cool.
Now, I remember a story that made the news several years ago that Matthew Perry said he went to school with Justin Trudeau. Was that the same school? Was Matthew Perry there at the same time as well?
Yeah, we're all at the same school, yeah. So Matthew played at the same tennis club that I did. He was a lot better tennis player. So Matthew Perry stars in Friends. Justin Trudeau, it's the Prime Minister, and I throw T-shirts at sporting events.
Hey, I tell you one thing. I think you've got the more interesting of the three. I mean, Prime Minister, come on. People have done that before. Friends, oh, there were six of them. You're the only Cameron Hughes.
Yeah, exactly.
Come on.
Oh, come on. Thank you. Appreciate the cheer.
Yeah, exactly. Emmys, millions of dollars, running a country. Who cares about those? I want to go to sporting events.
Yeah, the stress and pressure of that. I just get to twirl T-shirts and make kids smile.
At what point, then, do you realize that this is sort of your career after that Senators game and you start doing more of this? I mean, is there just a light bulb moment where you go, hang on a minute, this is my job?
There's a few light bulb moments that kind of got brighter as I kept going. A big one for me was after doing it in Ottawa, my friends dared me to go to Toronto after they didn't make the playoffs in year two. Went down to Toronto to see if it could work at Maple Leaf Gardens back in the day. And, you know, Toronto's like huge hockey town and the team was good. They were in the playoffs and I showed up there and I had a bunch of different moments, but one moment stuck out that was like, I was on Hockey Night in Canada. They were talking about me. They were saying, wow, look at this kid from Ottawa. He's got the crowd going. I think they used the word motivational consultant. I don't know where they got that, but pretty funny what people have called me over the years. So I'm driving back to Ottawa the next day. Thankfully I got paid. So I had some gas money and I was like, I realized that the crowd in Ottawa isn't really different than the crowd in Toronto. They all want the same thing, right? We all want human interaction. We want spontaneous human interaction. We want to feel alive. So when I look back at my career, I look at from those games to, you know, 26 years later at a rugby game in Singapore or at a hockey game in the middle of Texas. It's the same thing you want to create, right? So that moment driving back made me go, the crowds are all the same, in my humble opinion. It's how we interact with them. So that was the first one. And then there's a series of them that kept building up. And then I started to get paid well enough to make a living. So it was crazy.
You talk about, though, like at the end of the day, everyone's the same. They all want the same thing to win, of course. But there's got to be some fan bases that are a little bit harder to get involved than others, surely. Are you able to name those at all?
Well, I mean, we could talk about New Jersey. I was brought in to do the Devils game. I think it was 2008 or 2009. Yeah. And the guys who brought me in said that, you know, the team never markets because they were winning without marketing. And I remember doing the game very vividly. I got up, no reaction. Got up again, no reaction. Like four or five times. And I'm just like, I got to get out of here. You know what I mean? And then I realized I can't leave because you only get paid if you get the crowd going. That's what they've asked you to do. Mm-hmm. You know, I always joke that I don't like the word job because it's only a way of life. But that's literally my job that night. Get the crowd going. And when you don't have a reaction, you just want to run for your life. So I found a way, you know, and you work better timing, more t-shirts, crazier dancing, wait for a big play and go for it.
And in terms of the different sports as well, you've not just, of course, worked at hockey. You mentioned rugby. You've worked at NBA. I mean, you name the sporting event, you've basically done it. Is there a favorite event or sort of sport that you found that maybe you weren't familiar with going into that all of a sudden you found this is a great place to be able to get a crowd, you know, raucous and up and going?
Two things come to mind, but off the top of my head would be tennis. About 11 years ago, I went to the US Open with a friend of mine and I was like, wow, I think I could do it here. And he's like, you're crazy. So the next year I somehow got in the door. And tennis is funny because you don't see that in the big matches during the commercial breaks, you don't see what's happening in the stadiums. And I'm not saying they're bringing out, you know, tricycles and doing crazy races and, you know, wrestling matches. I'm just saying that there's a moment where you can fire up the fans. So I ended up doing the US Open for 8 years, led to some of the most memorable moments of my career. The first year, by the way, they didn't want to bring me in. So I said, give me a dollar, just give me one shot, see if it works. And it worked and it kind of blew up. And then next thing I know, I'm dancing with Novak Djokovic center court on live on ESPN. And actually my friends in Australia were messaging me because they were watching it live. And I was like, this is crazy. And they're like, did you plan that? I'm like, come on, I'm not that smart. And then next thing I know, I'm being asked to perform at Roger Federer's charity event for a couple of years. And so it's just saying yes to things and putting myself out there has led to some really cool things.
Who's a better dancer, Novak Djokovic or Roger Federer?
I'm going to have to give that one to Novak, but don't tell Roger I said that.
I won't. I mean, but he's allowed to be better than, you know, Roger in one thing, isn't he?
There you go. I got a chance to meet Novak, Rafa, and Roger, and they're all lovely gentlemen, very attentive when you're with them, but they also all have one, you know, like their thing, you know, and you realize why they're successful.
And I can imagine, though, as a fan yourself, you're doing this because you're wanting to get the crowd involved, but you're also a sports fan. So to have these opportunities to meet people like that, to get to go to other events, I mean, you've been to Olympic Games, Rugby World Cups, you know, these massive sporting events too. Do you ever just take a moment to kind of pinch yourself to realize that not only are you here doing a pretty amazing, well, I don't want to call it a job, a pretty amazing task that you're there to getting paid to do, but you're also experiencing many things that people have on their bucket list and won't get to see in their lives?
Yeah, it's kind of crazy. You know, behind the scenes is, you know, you're back there and you're seeing things that are happening. And there's lots of moments that I share in the book and lots that I couldn't because there's just kind of too many, like the weird and wonderful. After Canada won the gold medal in Vancouver 2010, I was at the party at Molson, had a big tent, and I ran into the CEO of Hockey Canada, Bob Nicholson, and he goes, come with me. And he opens the door and next thing I know, there's Sidney Crosby who's just scored the winning goal and I'm talking to him and then he's in a private room because he would get hounded. And then he opens the next door and it's all the players and they're drinking champagne out of these Molson Magnums. And I'm just like, there I am. And I come back half an hour later and my friends are like, where were you? I'm like, oh, nowhere, you know?
Nah,
so yeah, important. I mean, it does take you to some pretty cool places.
When it comes to going to an event like the US Open or doing something Olympics, is it a case of you selling yourself? Do people approach you, or has it kind of fluctuated over your career in terms of how each of that opportunity presents itself?
Yeah, it's definitely fluctuated over my career. I mean, it's a really good question, actually. I'd actually be curious if I made a list of 20 events I've done, how I got them, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Because one, for example, like the Cleveland Cavaliers, I did it, I don't know, maybe 14 years ago. They saw me, the people who direct the game, at a minor league hockey game. They brought me in and they're like, we're going to try this in Cleveland. It worked. Other NBA teams saw me. They called me. And then the director of, you know, and the president of the Golden Knights used to work in Cleveland. And then he calls me, right? And then there's other events that I've reached out to and said, hey, you know, do you want something? Do you need something? For example, some hockey I've done in Europe. I had a friend contact me with a guy who was Canadian who ran a Belfast Giants hockey team. And he hadn't thought about me, but he'd seen me, which is good. So sometimes you just need that intro.
And does it come with those intros as well, that you have a rate that you kind of charge, or does it depend on the sport? Does it depend on what they're willing to offer? I mean, how does the monetary aspect of it work?
Well, yeah, I mean, I figured that out over the years. You know, what are you worth and what value are you worth? And, you know, I think my career did better in the last 5 or 6 years when I increased my rate because it increased the value. And also, I felt like I was earning that, you know, like it was like, you know, some of the places I was going to, I remember going to Singapore and they flew me over, and I joke, it's the only time I've been able to demand first class. You know, I landed in Singapore and the flight was delayed, and 2 hours later I'm performing for 35,000 people. And within a week or two, it had, I think, 2.5-3 million views on Facebook. So like, what's the, you know, it doesn't happen all the time, don't get me wrong, but you know, I've done the US Open where there I am dancing center court live at ESPN. And it's like, okay, well, what was that worth? So you try to value what you're doing without, you know, I've always said I should get a bonus if I end up on SportsCenter or if the tweet goes viral. Nobody said yes to that yet.
So, yet being the operative word. And does that then lead to people coming to you wanting to do what you want to do? Do you take under an apprentice? Do you give people advice? Or are you kind of just in that unique position where you're it? You're kind of the one in this industry, so to speak, and there will be never another Cameron Hughes.
Yeah, that's a funny one, because I remember being on two parts. One, I remember spraining my ankle earlier in my career and going, hey, what if I can't do this? And then I kind of forgot about it because I've had quite a few injuries. And then I was on a plane once with this guy who was a business guy, and he ended up getting like a spreadsheet almost out, and he was like showing me how I could leverage what I'm doing. And I was like, I've thought about it, but then I would have to be worrying about Mitch in Oklahoma City tonight or Laura in, you know, Calgary. And I'm like, the margins just didn't make sense. And I also had a lot I wanted to do, and maybe one day I'll have a few people out there, but I also think teams have their own characters and personalities, you know?
In terms of the current situation, of course, it's been a little bit tricky for someone like yourself who sort of lives and breathes going to sporting events. How have you been coping outside of writing the book, of course? Sort of what have you been up to? Do you just do virtual events now? Do you kind of join esports or something like that? What works?
Yeah. Well, it's funny. I was down in California and I remember going for a walk and it was pouring rain. I was like, okay, my pity parade is over. I got to get at it. So I started to make crazy. I went to my storage. I got all of my hockey jerseys and sports jerseys out. I had 400 jerseys from around the world. And I started to make crazy videos, posted them everywhere. And people are like, is everything okay? I'm like, yeah, it's great. And through that, all these people are like, oh, I want to hire you to energize my event. Because in April, we didn't know what it looked like and people had to switch and pivot and they still had budgets. So I was crashing Zoom meetings around the world.
Wow.
From Toronto to Singapore to Boston to schools to like, I was just crashing all these Zoom meetings and then being asked to speak at like commencement talks. And so I've done, and then the best one is probably about 60 different personalized videos for people. I just do it from the goodness of my heart. I know there's apps that you can make money doing it, but I just felt it was a good thing to do.
And is it something that once we get back up and running again, back to full crowds in arenas and things like that, that you're already kind of mapping out where you're going to go, where you're going to be, or have you already got teams kind of going, okay, as soon as we go, we're going to need these guys revved up. They've missed us. Come on, boom, get back into the arena, Cameron.
I think that, you know, for me, I still want to do it, which is a good thing because I've been doing it for a long time. I kind of have my list ready to go of what I want to still do. And then I, you know, as I've said to a few people, I think the teams are going to have a responsibility to crank up the engagement and turn down the corporate sponsors and corporate selling at the games and just like get the engagement level and the energy up at these games because people are going to need to let go and connect.
Have you ever been to Australia? Has your talents taken you to Australia to any of our events in that part of the world before?
I went to a Waratahs match years and years and years ago, probably 14 years ago, and I had an idea that maybe I would do the game, but truth be told, we went to a pub before the match and it was just not a good idea.
Yeah, I think you struggled.
I wasn't
super
in the right
rugby.
Frame of mind.
Yes, yeah. Super Rugby is an interesting crowd. I would highly recommend going to an Australian football game if you're ever in Melbourne. Get to go to the
MCG. I definitely want to see that. I've always wanted to do the Australian Open tennis, but they won't bring me in because I do the US Open, which is, I find that entertaining, but I get it. I've always wanted to do a match in Australia for sure.
Yeah, definitely. And in terms of where you are at now, Cameron, you're now living here in Victoria. Sort of what brought you out to this part of the world? And do you often get to some of the Victorian games or are we not there yet? You haven't had an opportunity to?
Yeah, I've done enough events here. I've done the Salmon Kings, who used to be in the ECHL. I did the Team Canada events here back in the day at the arena. And then I've done a bunch of Royals games over the years. So I came here to initially kind of launch the book and drive across Canada. And now I'm set here. I'm going to stay here for a while and set up a little fun studio. And I love it here. We've been coming here for 5 years. My partner makes films here. So
great.
We're excited to make this home for a while. And we're both Canadian and, you know, it's a beautiful place to be.
How do you find the Victorian fan base? Are they just a regular fan base? Are they more difficult, easier to kind of engage with? Is there sort of a way you can judge that?
I think they're very similar to a lot of the CHL, sort of the minor league hockey games I've done where they know a lot about the players. They know a lot about the team. There's a huge percentage of them that really, you know, follow it, care deeply about the team. And then there's probably the 20 to 30% that come that night because it was a fun thing to do. So it's always a balance between the fan that really wants to watch the game. And then there's the fan that just wants to let go. But I also think in my personal opinion, look, you buy a ticket, you can do what you want with it. Right. I always joke with fans, but I also think that there's a certain responsibility that comes with going to a live event. At times the fans need to, you know, get involved, you know, like the team needs you right now. Give them a little cheer, get the go Royals go, you know, go Royals go going. I haven't said that in a while. So, you know what I mean? So it's a balance, right? You let them watch the game, but also like own the moments.
Can you actually have teams that you root for, given that you're sort of paid by teams to cheer? And are you kind of like a referee where you do have teams, but you're not allowed to publicly admit who you actually do go for?
Well, I remember being at the Vancouver Olympics. It was the gold medal game. And the organizers were like, don't be too pro-Canada. And I was like, okay, sure. So I obviously had a Team Canada jersey on.
Yeah, how does that work? Don't be too pro-Canada.
Nobody said a word. I've had some funny moments in my career, some good and some bad where, you know, teams, like I remember doing the New Jersey Devils where a few fans were like, you're not from here. And like one guy came after me, he had to be kicked out of the arena. I was like, that wasn't fun. And then minor league hockey games where one night I'm in Oklahoma, the next night I'm in Tulsa, you know, and the fan bases are like, wait a minute, didn't I just see you in Oklahoma? And I'm like, yeah, how you doing? At the end of the day, I've never pretended to be, you know, the quote unquote super fan or the ultimate fan of any team. It's more like I'm here to provide a spark and have some fun and get things going.
You mentioned 400 jerseys. What's your favorite?
My favorite would probably be the first Senators jersey that they gave me in 1994 that looks like a bit of a rag, but it's still signed. And I never framed it because I wanted to wear it. And it was just like, that's what they paid me for the first game.
Wow.
So, yeah, it holds a lot of memories because it's you know, it's a lot of hustle, a lot of putting yourself out there, a lot of believing in yourself to get to, you know, where I am, which is, you know, I'm at a point where I felt I had enough stories to write a book. That's where I am. That's, you know, that's all.
Before I let you go, Cameron, probably the one question you get asked a lot, but I'm going to be a cliche and ask it anyway. What's the one event that you haven't done that you would love to be able to do one day?
Oh, my first like thought came to mind would be the Super Bowl. The Super Bowl, but with like 60 seconds of airtime, because I did the Grey Cup in 2008 in Montreal, and then I hosted it, almost ripped my pants, but that's another story. And they gave me 60 seconds on the clock, like where it was, there was, it was coming to me, it was uninterrupted. And if I did that at the Super Bowl, it would work. You know what I mean?
Yep. Indeed.
The Super Bowl would be a great one.
Well, we'll keep an eye out on that, and perhaps if you want
to hear... And the Royals and the Memorial Cup, obviously.
Absolutely, of course. And for some of our listeners, the Canucks winning a Stanley Cup finally. So, you know,
no, not
like that.
The Canucks, sorry.
No? Okay, what? Well, screw the Canucks. I didn't say that either. What are you talking about? We'll edit that out later.
Exactly.
If you want to learn more about Cameron's amazing career, the pants ripping at the Grey Cup, everything else, of course, King of Cheer, available now. CameronHughes.tv is where you can find that. Cameron, this has been a lot of fun, mate. Really a pleasure to have you on the show, and I look forward to seeing you in our arenas. I've never been to a Royals game yet, haven't had that opportunity, but I hope to be bumping shoulders with you at a Royals game at some point soon in the future.
We will get back and bring the cheer. Thanks for having me.
Coming up, all the day's news plus your weekly dose of random Aussie goodness next. Get connected to over 41,000 subscribers each day with one of the smartest, largest and most engaged news audiences on the West Coast, all while supporting Vancouver Island's most dynamic source for in-depth news and analysis. Visit capitaldaily.ca for more details. To the day's news now, and BC Seniors Advocate Isabel McKenzie and the BC Care Providers Association want rapid COVID testing in care homes as outbreaks increase. The tests sacrifice some accuracy to get results in under half an hour, but McKenzie argues they could provide a valuable extra layer of screening and catch cases in people not showing any symptoms. The BCCPA released an independent report making the same recommendation. When announcing the report, BCCPA CEO Terry Lake said rapid testing protocols and systems are a must. The report also called for the creation of specialised COVID-19 units, with the aim being to reduce COVID-19 transmission in the most vulnerable populations. Dr. Bonnie Henry has said that the rapid tests have faults and limitations, primarily their lack of accuracy. Last month, Capital Daily science writer Harley Gordon looked at how rapid tests could impact various sectors, writing that in care homes, they could have a good social impact by reducing waits for family visitation. The Independent Investigations Office is looking into the death of a man who spent more than 2 hours in a Victoria Police cell before later dying in hospital. Police said they received a report of a man causing a disturbance in the 600 block of Douglas on November 20 at 1:45 a.m. He was later arrested, medically cleared, and confined in police cells. At 4:15 a.m. he appeared to be in medical distress, and the police called emergency health services, who transported him to hospital where he died at an undisclosed time. The IIO will now investigate what role police actions or inactions may have played. Earlier this year, a coroner's inquest intended to help prevent deaths in or after police custody was delayed by COVID-19. That inquest will examine the case of a Heshkwiat teenager, Jocelyn George, who was held overnight by Port Alberni RCMP, had a cardiac arrest, and later died after being airlifted to Victoria. A 2018 IIO report did not recommend charges against those officers, but the New Charnels Tribal Council said the report's contents highlighted Indigenous mistreatment by police and the need for policies on holding intoxicated persons to be reformed. And the BC Liberal Party caucus has chosen Shirley Bond as interim leader. The six-term Prince George Vallemount MLA was BC's 10th Deputy Premier under Gordon Campbell, and in 2011 became the first woman to serve as Attorney General. Bond now replaces Vancouver Quilchena MLA Andrew Wilkinson, who resigned 2 days after the provincial election and stepped down as interim leader this past weekend. And before we go today, it's that time of the week to bring you some random Aussie news from my homeland, which of course means one thing. That beauty of a song can be played. This week I have the story of a local celebrity in the town of Bunbury in Western Australia who is famous for simply looking like someone famous. Phil Mennell has a striking resemblance to the iconic TV character Walter White, played by Bryan Cranston on Breaking Bad. Mennell was first approached back at a Christmas party in 2008 when a girl came up to him and said that he looked like the infamous character. He told ABC News Australia that by the end of the night, more than 50 people had taken photos of him, and after leaving the party, people would continue to stop him and recognise him. It is something to this day that still happens, and the incident led him to eventually watching the series, a series that he promptly fell in love with. And obviously, given this is an audio medium, I can't really show you the picture, but take my word on it. When I say he looks exactly like Walter White, I'm talking bald head, goatee, glasses. It's actually quite incredible. I just hope that he never takes up chemistry as a career, because then people might start questioning just what path he is taking and how deep into this whole doppelganger thing he is actually getting. And that's it today for the Capital Daily Podcast for Wednesday, November 25th, 2020. 1 month to Christmas today, folks. There's a scary thought for you. Tune in tomorrow as we catch up with the legendary BC Lions fullback Sean Millington on the 20th anniversary of the Lions' iconic 2000 Grey Cup win. It's a great chat that you won't want to miss. That's tomorrow on the Capital Daily Podcast. My name is Ben Waterworth, and as they say in Australia, always check your shoes for spiders. Thanks for tuning in, and I will speak to you tomorrow. Today's edition of the Capital Daily Podcast is brought to you by us, Capital Daily. With a committed audience of over 41,000 people, get connected with some of the smartest, hippest people on the West Coast. For more details, visit capitaldaily.ca. Never miss what's happening in Victoria and on Vancouver Island by subscribing to the Capital Daily newsletter. Each morning, you'll receive all the latest news delivered directly to your inbox, compiled by the experienced Capital Daily team to ensure you are up to date with what's happening on the island and beyond. To subscribe, simply head to capitaldaily.ca.